It's really great to be back to the Commodity Classic. It's one of the events I look forward to as Secretary, an opportunity to talk to friends and neighbors who are out there every single day working in the fields, providing the world the finest quality and the greatest quantity of commodities. You know, it's an interesting time for us in agriculture and in this country. You know, the president often talks about rebuilding the middle class of this country. He talks about bottom up and middle out, rebuilding the great middle class, because he believes, and I believe, and I suspect you do too, that one of the critical components of the success of America has been the fact that we've had a strong middle class. Folks who get up every single day, who work hard, play by the rules, and have at their very core the desire to make sure that their children and grandchildren have a better future. It's part of the secret sauce of our great country. And there's no greater representative of that middle class than Americans, farmers, ranchers, and producers, in my view. And this came to light recently when I was looking at income statistics that were reported to me in the office of Secretary. And folks came in and they were kind of excited. They said, "Mr. Secretary, we want you to know the last 2 years have been the best 2 years in farm income in the history of the United States." And I thought to myself, gee, if I give speeches and I start with that, again, I should probably walk off the stage to applause. But then I looked deeper into the numbers, and here's what I found, and here's why I'm here today. What I found was that in that record set of years, nearly 50% of our farmers, ranchers, and producers lost money. Another nearly 40% of those who work hard every single day made some money from their farm, but the majority of money that they made for their family, that supported their family, came from off-farm income. So nearly 90% of those who work hard every single day to produce this incredible bounty either didn't make money or didn't make the majority of the money that they made from farming during record income levels. Which meant that the top 10%, the folks who sell more than $1 million of product every year, did very well. And about 40% of those folks are actually investment bankers, folks who own land. So I thought about this notion of bottom up and middle out. It seems to me that we need to look at why that is so. Why in a record year, a few folks benefit but not many or most. And what's interesting is I went back and looked at the history of the Department of Agriculture, and I'm fortunate I have on my desk back in Washington, D.C., a volume that was the first report of the Commission of Agriculture after its first year of operation, after Abraham Lincoln established it in 1862. The commissioner, a fellow by the name of Isaac Newton, not the real Isaac Newton, but a different Isaac Newton, wrote a 632-page book about the activities of the department. And in that book, his first 25 pages is a preamble of his thoughts and theories and ideas about the department. And what he raised as concern was the consolidation of land ownership, suggesting that it was the consolidation of land ownership, it was the lack of a middle class in the great Roman Empire that ultimately led to the demise of that great Roman Empire. Fast forward and you think about the pivotal moments in our history of agriculture. In the New Deal, the Dust Bowl, confronted with just tremendous grief and pain, we put together a program, started focusing on conservation, created supply management, and for a period of time, farmers did pretty well. And then in the early 70s, Secretary Butts made the decision that it was appropriate and necessary for us to move away from that system to a more market-driven system, a focus on production. If you remember, he may have encouraged all of us to think about fence row to fence row. And so American farmers reacted and responded, and boy, did they do an amazing job. In my lifetime, the productivity of American farming has increased 17 times. It is a remarkable story of productivity. But the reality is that the more productive we became, the more expensive it was. And so it became necessary for folks to look at and to think about spreading the cost of that over a larger and larger base. And with that, we had larger and larger farms and fewer farmers. And it wasn't just the impact on the farmers. It was the impact on the communities where those farmers lived, those small towns, because if there are fewer farmers, then there are fewer customers for that small town business on the main street. There are fewer kids in the school. There are fewer folks living in the community that can support a hospital and a number of docks. And so rural America, which is, I think, the heartbeat of this notion of a middle class, began to be challenged. So what do we do about this? Well, historically, the focus has been on trying to figure out ways to help farmers stay in business. We look at ways to reduce inputs, for example. And we're doing that. We just recently announced, not long ago, a fertilizer initiative, understanding and appreciating the amazing pressure farmers were under with the Ukrainian circumstance and conflict and war. We saw a tremendous increase and spike in fertilizer costs, affecting every agricultural production system in the country. So we announced the notion of looking for ways where we could immediately identify programs and opportunities to increase production here in the U.S., and then a longer-term strategy. We divided a $500 million effort into two phases. Phase one was, what can you do now for 23 and 24 crop year, and what can you do long-term to make us more self-reliant when it comes to inputs? And today we're announcing $29 million of grants to eight independent businesses that are located in the states of Alabama, Colorado, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Washington, where resources are going to be used to modernize equipment, to advance climate-smart practices, to build production operations and facilities, and to expand the capacity of fertilizer production here in the United States. For example, Purcell Agritech, which is a facility located in Alabama, is going to focus on increasing the productivity and production of controlled-release fertilizer. They hope to be able to increase their supply by as much as 40,000 tons with the small grant that we're providing. There's a facility in Missouri that's focused on a microbial fertilizer, where they're producing about 8,000 gallons of that a week. Now they feel with the grant we're giving them, they could increase to 120,000 gallons a week. There's another facility in Missouri as well that's constructing a new plant, and with our grant they're going to be able to accelerate the timeline to be able to impact and affect probably 24 crops. So we are in the process of trying to work and focus on reducing input costs. And our phase two portion of this effort, we received $3 billion in requests, 350 applications over 47 states and two territories. So there's genuine interest in this, and we're going to continue to try to figure out ways in which we can provide support and help to reduce inputs. We focus on competition also as a way of addressing this issue of 90% and 10%. We've funded, as of this week, 31 processing facilities for meat, poultry, and processed eggs, all parts of the country. More to come, for sure. We issued a seed report this week, because we understand and appreciate some of the challenges that farmers have with reference to seed and seed technology and the cost of seed. We established a report, More and Better Choices for Farmers, focusing on seed innovation and other inputs. And in that seed report, we took three actions. We've created a liaison between the Department of Agriculture and farmers and breeders so that you all will have input as folks are interested in establishing patent protection, which oftentimes is designed initially to provide and to promote innovation, but can be used in a way to stifle it. Now, this liaison is going to make sure that farmer input, farmer concerns, farmer awareness is heightened as these applications for patents are reviewed. We've established a working group with the Patent Trade Office, and that working group is going to work with the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission to make sure that as patents are being considered, that we look at the impact of them from a regional perspective. As you well know, when you're purchasing seed, sometimes you're purchasing seed with multiple traits. Some of those traits are very important to your region, but oftentimes there are traits that aren't necessarily needed on your farm. It's sort of like your cable vision bill, where you're paying for 500 channels, 490 of which you'll never watch. The question is, why are we paying for the traits that we don't absolutely need? This working group is going to make sure that your input in all of this is considered. And we put a notice to trade out, encouraging folks to provide information about the variety and type of seed being sold as quickly as possible to the farmer and to the businesses selling to the farmer, so that you're always aware of what it is you're actually buying. So the point of this is we're trying to help ensure that there's going to continue to be innovation, but that you are paying for that innovation at a reasonable cost. So that's a strategy that we've incorporated, and we've incorporated that forever. We've focused on trade. You know, clearly we understand the importance of trade, and we've had record years. The last 2 years have been record years in trade. And it's fairly clear that we believe in a science-based and rules-based system. It's fundamental to our approach to trade. And so when Mexico and the Mexican president issued his decree, raising concerns and doubts about the safety of biotechnology corn, suggesting bans or the lack of use of that corn, we felt that there was not a scientific basis for that decree. We questioned it. We asked the president to reconsider. He was unwilling to do this, and so we began with the U.S. Trade Representative's Office the formal process under USMCA in a consultation to make sure that we defend the notion of a science-based trading system, that we send a strong message to the world about the safety of biotech products, and we ensure that we continue to have market access. So we continue to do all of that. We've always talked about trade. We've always talked about input costs. We've always talked about ways in which we could help farmers. But yet still today, in a record year, 10%, 90%, we've got to do more. And I'm here today to make the case that more involves not just establishing and focusing on input costs, and we need to do that, and we will. Not just focusing on trade because it's incredibly important. We will continue to do that. But we have to do more at the Department of Agriculture. The industry has to do more. And so I'm here today to suggest that the way to do this is to focus as well on additional income streams or market opportunities for producers, taking that same farmstead, and instead of just relying on commodity sales or livestock sales or government payments, creating 3, 4, 5 different profit centers on that same farm. So that if commodity prices are not good, if there's drought or whatever it might be, there are other things that are providing income that aren't necessarily directly connected to that commodity. Without any additional work, if you will. That's one of the reasons why we promoted Climate Smart Commodities. The notion of taking Climate Smart practices and producing a commodity that has an added value that the market will reflect and will pay. As you know, we put out $1 billion. We asked agriculture and we asked farmers and ranchers, how would you set this program up? You were pretty clear about it. You said it needed to be voluntary, it needed to be incentive-based, it needed to be market-oriented, and it needed to have a strong measurement, monitoring, reporting, and verification system. We put $1 billion out with that criteria, voluntary, market-driven, incentive-based, strong reporting verification systems. Hoped that we would get some applications. We got over 1,000 applications. We were able to fund 141 of them. Every commodity is involved. Every state of the country is involved. We expect over 60,000 producers to be involved, 25 million acres. And what we're going to be able to do is to begin to establish a new concept that will provide additional income for farmers as they embrace climate smart practice, knowing full well that we have to provide the resources to embrace those climate smart practices, that we can't ask farmers to do it on their own. And so today, after this speech, I have an opportunity to witness the signing of some of the first two agreements. We're going to look at an agreement that the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is leading, called Climate Smart Ag Commodity Partnership, an opportunity for farmers for soil health, a Climate Smart Commodity Partnership to focus on cover crops. They expect and anticipate to use this resource that we're providing to impact 1 million acres over 20 states. And the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation doing this in conjunction with the Corn Growers Association, the Soybean Board, conservation districts around the country. And we're also going to see the signing of the Midwest Climate Smart Commodity Program, where the Iowa Soybean Association is the lead. But they're working with Cargill, with PepsiCo and Target, market-oriented opportunities to develop customer-based and outcome-based contracts for soybean growers, for corn, for wheat, for sugar beets, to be able to provide the resources that a Pepsi and a Cargill need and that Target sells. Now, the notion behind this is that you create that value-added opportunity, but in addition, as you're doing that, you're also going to be able to allow those farmers to qualify for what are called ecosystem service markets. Now, what are they? They're carbon markets, they're wildlife markets, they're water markets. There are 24 of these markets today in America. These are markets that pay for conservation results, for environmental results, for greenhouse gas reductions, for carbon sequestration, for carbon storage results, which farmers are going to be able to provide. That's a new income source that didn't exist before. And with these investments that USDA is providing, the resources, the partnerships that we're developing, you not only have a new value-added opportunity, which is a new income source, but you also have ecosystem service markets. We're excited about that. And we're excited about the Inflation Reduction Act resources for conservation that give us the opportunity to ensure that as we learn what works from this, that we can funnel and provide additional resources. So instead of two or three ways to make money on that farm, now we have four or five ways to make money. We have the opportunity to expand significantly renewable energy production. With the Inflation Reduction Act, there's an historic amount of money in the Renewable Energy for America program where farmers can essentially on their own farm create a solar system or a windmill that allows them to produce their own energy. And maybe they produce excess energy, which they can put on the grid. And as they put it on the grid, they get paid for it. And as they get paid for it, they have another income source. And this is going to be a massive opportunity. Why? Because RECs across the United States are going to, over time, decarbonize their systems. They're going to rely more and more and more on renewable systems and less on fossil fuel-based systems. And as they do, they're going to be looking for the generation and transmission capacity. That's a new income source that farmers can consider. And I fully appreciate the concerns that farmers have about the expanse of large-scale renewable energy. We want to make sure that we work with those who are interested in doing that to make sure that they're not taking highly productive land out of production, but that they're utilizing that opportunity for less productive land. So in turn, we have yet another income source. It doesn't stop there. The notion of bio-based product production. We recently provided resources to a soybean a company in Ames, Iowa, that is basically transitioning soybean oil into a thermoplastic rubber that is a low-cost paving product. In other words, it will help road construction and reduce the cost to counties and cities of road repairs. Folks, this is an amazing new opportunity to take an agricultural product and convert it into something more valuable. That does two things. It creates yet another revenue source for farmers, but it also creates processing jobs and manufacturing jobs in rural places. The Department of Agriculture has a bio-preferred program where we're encouraging federal agencies to buy bio-based products. There are 139 categories of those products, 139 categories. Within each category, there are numerous products. So we're talking about literally hundreds of opportunities to create new manufacturing and new opportunities for farmers. We all know about biofuels. We all know about the importance of continuing to stress E15, continue to stress the need for soy diesel, continue to focus on ways in which we can expand that traditional biofuel industry, but there's a new industry forthcoming. And that new industry is sustainable aviation fuel. You know, I get electric cars. I totally get them. You know, you drive them. If the charge wears out, you pull to the side of the road, you pick up your cell phone, you call for a charge, you get back on the road. But seriously, what if you're in a plane and it's over a body of water? We need a sustainable low-carbon fuel. It's a 36-billion-gallon industry that doesn't exist today, for all intents and purposes. It's a new opportunity for American agriculture to lead the way. So instead of two or three ways of selling a crop and selling livestock and getting a government payment, you've got an opportunity for a climate-smart commodity. You've got an opportunity for an ecosystem service market. You have an opportunity for a bio-based product ingredient. You've got an opportunity for biofuels. You've got an opportunity for renewable energy production. So we're creating new markets. And all of this has been funded to get started by the American Rescue Plan resources, the infrastructure law, and the Inflation Reduction Act. This is a pivotal, historic, transformational moment for American agriculture. It really complements the ability to lower input costs. It complements the notion of trade. It expands significantly the entrepreneurial opportunities for small and mid-sized farming operations. It allows you to go in that dining room, around that coffee table with that hot cup of coffee, and talk to your sons and daughters and your grandkids about something exciting and incredibly important that's going to allow them to continue to do what you want them to do and what they want to do, which is to farm. It's going to continue to allow us to have family farming operations that can be transferred and continue to be transferred for 5, 6, 7, 8 generations. It's an exciting new opportunity. And it is right here. It is right now. It's a pivotal moment. And with the Farm Bill conversation coming up, what we have is the opportunity to ensure that these kinds of opportunities remain viable, an opportunity to expand significantly. So at the end of the day, we have a Farm Bill that doesn't benefit a few, but a Farm Bill that benefits the many and the most. That's the goal. Now, why do it? Why do it? Well, there's the obvious reason, which is we want to improve farm income. We don't want to have record years where not everybody benefits. By creating more markets and more profit opportunities, we can create more chances for farmers to actually make money. Why do it? Well, of course, there's the reason for additional rural jobs. But to me, what this is an opportunity to rebuild the middle class, the rural middle class. Now, why is that important? It's important for two reasons. And I say this to every audience I speak to. You've heard it before. You're going to hear it again, because I just think it's an incredibly important point. Number one, every single person in this country, and there are roughly 320 million of us, who are not farmers. We don't farm. We never even thought about farming. We don't have to. Why? Because all we have to focus on is a paycheck. If we have a paycheck, it means we can go to a grocery store and we can buy everything we need for our families. So it gave us the freedom to think about, in my case, being a lawyer. In my wife Christy's case, being a teacher. It gave us that option. We didn't have to think about, my God, how am I going to produce something to feed our two sons? We just simply went to a grocery store. That is a tremendous gift that you all, the farmers, the ranchers, the producers of this great country have provided to every single American. And frankly, we don't thank you enough. We don't thank you enough. But you do something in addition. In addition to creating this enormously complex economy because all of us are free to go out and do something other than farming because you're so extraordinarily good at it, you've created this complex economy that has provided the greatest and strongest nation in the world. And you don't get enough thanks for that. You've created a food secure nation where we don't have to worry about where our food comes from. You all produce it. That's not true in a lot of countries. China, for one, they have to depend on somebody else. They have to depend on us. We don't have to depend on anybody. That's a great gift. That makes us a more secure nation. And on top of all of that, folks in rural communities, folks on those farms and ranches, they send their sons and daughters into the military in disproportionate numbers. On any given year, 15% of our country's population lives in rural places, but it could be as much as 30% of our military. Why is that? Some will say it's because folks want to get want to have experiences. They want to see what the world looks like. That may be part of it, but I think there's a much deeper reason. I think kids who grow up in areas that are surrounded by farmlands and ranchlands and groves, they understand a very basic fundamental principle of life, which you all have taught them, which is that you can't keep taking from something that gives value to you. How do I know that you know that? Because you do this with your land every single year. You know that it can't keep producing for you unless you put something back into it. You replenish it. You revive it. You nourish it. You have a relationship with it. You are stewards of it. Because you understand that if you do that, it will continue to help you and your family. That is an incredibly fundamental principle. An important principle that these young people understand and appreciate, that when they grow up in a country like the one we are in, that notwithstanding all of our faults, it is the greatest country on earth. It is a country that provides enormous liberty and freedom for us to be able to dream big dreams and actually accomplish them, to be able to think we can do just about anything. In my case, to come from an orphanage in Pennsylvania, to be speaking to thousands of people as the Secretary of Agriculture, this is a great country. And because it is a great country, each of us needs to do what farmers do. We need to replenish this country. We need to nourish it. And we do it with our sacrifice and our service. We do it by participating in our democracy. We do it in lots of different ways. But these kids understand that because you've taught them that. And so when we talk about rebuilding the middle class, when we talk about rebuilding this rural place, this is why it's important. That we not only focus on inputs, not only focus on trade, not only focus on safety net, all of which is incredibly important, but that we continue to build more and more and more markets so that that small and mid-sized producer can benefit, can profit, and can eventually say to their sons and daughters, there is true opportunity, there's entrepreneurship, you can continue to contribute to your country and make a difference in the world by doing a job that is the greatest job, and that is to be a farmer, a rancher, or a producer. God bless you all.